Montag ran. He could feel the hound, like autumn, some cold and dry and swift, like a wind that didn't stir grass, that didn't jar windows or disturb leaf shadows on the white sidewalks as it passed. The hound did not touch the world. It carried its silence with it, so you could feel the silence building up a pressure behind you all across town. Montag felt the pressure rising and ran. He stopped for breath on his way to the river to peer through dimly lit windows of wakened houses and saw the silhouettes of people inside watching their parlor walls, and there on the walls, the mechanical hound. A breath of neon vapor spidered along, here and gone, here and gone. Now at Elm Terrace, Lincoln, Oak, Park, and up the alley toward Faber's house. Go past, thought Montag. Don't stop. Go on. Don't turn in. On the parlor wall, Faber's house, with its sprinkler system pulsing in the night air, the hound paused, quivering. No. Montag held to the windowsill. This way. Here. The procaine needle flicked out and in, out and in. A single clear drop of the stuff of dreams fell from the needle as it vanished in the hound's muzzle. Montag held his breath like a doubled fist in his chest. The mechanical hound turned and plunged away from Faber's house down the alley again. Montag snapped his gaze to the sky. The helicopters were closer, a great blowing of insects to a single light source. With an effort, Montag reminded himself again that this was no fictional episode to be watched on his run to the river. It was, in actuality, his own chess game he was witnessing, move by move. He shouted to give himself the necessary push away from this last house window and the fascinating seance going on in there. Hell. And he was away and gone. The alley, a street, the alley, a street, and the smell of the river. Leg out, leg down, leg out and down. 20 million Montags running soon, if the cameras caught him. 20 million Montags running. Running like an ancient flickery, keystone comedy. Cops, robbers, chasers and the chased. Hunters and hunted. He had seen it 1,000 times. Behind him now, 20 million silently baying hounds ricocheted across parlors. 3 cushions shooting from right wall to center wall to left wall. Gone. Right wall, center wall, left wall. Gone. Montag jammed his seashell to his ear. Police suggest entire population in the Elm Terrace area do as follows. Everyone in every house, in every street. Open a front or rear door or look from the windows. The fugitive cannot escape if everyone in the next minute looks from his house. Ready. Of course, why hadn't they done it before? Why in all the years hadn't this game been tried? Everyone up, everyone out. He couldn't be missed. The only man running alone in the night city. The only man proving his legs. At the count of 10 now. 1, 2. He felt the city rise. 3. He felt the city turn to its thousands of doors. Faster. Leg up. Leg down. 4. The people sleepwalking in their hallways. 5. He felt their hands on the doorknobs. The smell of the river was cool and like a solid rain. His throat was burnt rust and his eyes were wept dry with running. He yelled as if this yell would jet him on, fling him the last 100 yards. 6, 7, 8. The doorknobs turned on 5,000 doors. 9. He ran out away from the last row of houses on a slope leading down to a solid moving blackness. 10. The doors opened. He imagined thousands on thousands of faces peering into yards, into alleys, and into the sky, faces hid by curtains, pale, night-frightened faces like gray animals peering from electric caves, faces with gray, colorless eyes, gray tongues, and gray thoughts looking out through the numb flesh of the face. But he was at the river. He touched it, just to be sure it was real. He waded in and stripped in darkness to the skin, splashing his body, arms, legs, and head with raw liquor, drank it, and snuffed some up his nose. Then he dressed in Faber's old clothes and shoes. He tossed his own clothing into the river and watched it swept away. Then, holding the suitcase, he walked out in the river until there was no bottom, and he was swept away in the dark. He was 300 yards downstream when the hound reached the river. Overhead, the great racketing fans of the helicopters hovered. A storm of light fell upon the river, and Montag dived under the great illumination as if the sun had broken the clouds. He felt the river pull him farther on its way into darkness. Then the light switched back to the land. The helicopters swerved over the city again as if they had picked up another trail. They were gone. The hound was gone. Now there was only the cold river, and Montag floating in a sudden peacefulness, away from the city and the lights and the chase, away from everything. He felt as if he had left a stage behind, and many actors. He felt as if he had left the great seance and all the murmuring ghosts. He was moving from an unreality that was frightening into a reality that was unreal, because it was new. The black land slid by, and he was going into the country among the hills. For the first time in a dozen years, the stars were coming out above him in great processions of wheeling fire. He saw a great juggernaut of stars form in the sky and threaten to roll over and crush him. He floated on his back when the valise filled and sank. The river was mild and leisurely, going away from the people who ate shadows for breakfast and steam for lunch and vapors for supper. The river was very real. It held him comfortably and gave him the time at last, the leisure to consider this month, this year, and a lifetime of years. He listened to his heart slow. His thoughts stopped rushing with his blood. He saw the moon low in the sky now. The moon there. And the light of the moon caused by what? By the sun, of course. And what lights the sun? Its own fire. And the sun goes on day after day, burning and burning. The sun and time. The sun and time and burning. Burning. The river bobbled him along gently. Burning. The sun and every clock on the earth. It all came together and became a single thing in his mind. After a long time of floating on the land, and a short time of floating in the river, he knew why he must never burn again in his life. The sun burnt every day. It burnt time. The world rushed in a circle and turned on its axis, and time was busy burning the years and the people anyway, without any help from him. So if he burnt things with the firemen, and the sun burnt time, that meant that everything burnt. One of them had to stop burning. The sun wouldn't, certainly. So it looked as if it had to be Montag and the people he had worked with until a few short hours ago. Somewhere, the saving and putting away had to begin again, and someone had to do the saving and keeping one way or another, in books, in records, in people's heads, any way at all, so long as it was safe, free from moths, silverfish, rust and dry rot, and men with matches. The world was full of burning, of all types and sizes. Now the Guild of the Asbestos Weaver must open shop very soon. He felt his heel bump land, touch pebbles and rocks, scrape sand. The river had moved him toward shore. He looked in at the great black creature without eyes or light, without shape, with only a size that went 1,000 miles without wanting to stop, with its grass hills and forests that were waiting for him. He hesitated to leave the comforting flow of the water. He expected the hound there. Suddenly the trees might blow under a great wind of helicopters. But there was only the normal autumn wind high up, going by like another river. Why wasn't the hound running? Why had the search veered inland? Montag listened. Nothing. Nothing. Millie, he thought. All this country here. Listen to it. Nothing and nothing. So much silence, Millie. I wonder how you'd take it. Would you shout, shut up, shut up? Millie. Millie. And he was sad. Millie was not here, and the hound was not here. But the dry smell of hay blowing from some distant field put Montag on the land. He remembered a farm he had visited when he was very young. One of the rare few times he discovered that somewhere behind the seven veils of unreality, beyond the walls of parlors and beyond the tin moat of the city, cows chewed grass and pigs sat in warm ponds at noon. and dogs barked after white sheep on a hill. Now the dry smell of hay, the motion of the waters, made him think of sleeping in fresh hay in a lonely barn, away from the loud highways, behind a quiet farmhouse, and under an ancient windmill that whirred like the sound of the passing years overhead. He lay in the high barn loft all night, listening to distant animals and insects and trees, the little motions and stirrings. During the night, he thought, below the loft, he would hear a sound like feet moving, perhaps. He would tense and sit up. The sound would move away. He would lie back and look out the loft window very late in the night and see the lights go out in the farmhouse itself, until a very young and beautiful woman would sit in an unlit window braiding her hair. It would be hard to see her, but her face would be like the face of the girl so long ago in his past now, so very long ago. The girl who had known the weather and never been burnt by the fireflies. The girl who had known what dandelions meant rubbed off on your chin. Then she would be gone from the warm window and appear again upstairs in her moon-whitened room. And then, to the sound of death, the sound of the jets cutting the sky in two black pieces beyond the horizon, he would lie in the loft, hidden and safe, watching those strange new stars over the rim of the earth, fleeing from the soft color of dawn. In the morning, he would not have needed sleep, for all the warm odors and sights of a complete country night would have rested and slept him while his eyes were wide and his mouth, when he thought to test it, was half a smile. And there at the bottom of the hayloft stair waiting for him would be the incredible thing. He would step carefully down in the pink light of early morning, so fully aware of the world that he would be afraid, and stand over the small miracle, and at last bend to touch it. A cool glass of fresh milk, and a few apples and pears laid at the foot of the steps. This was all he wanted now. Some signs that the immense world would accept him, and give him the long time he needed to think all the things that must be thought. A glass of milk, an apple, a pear. He stepped from the river. The land rushed at him, a tidal wave. He was crushed by darkness and the look of the country and the million odors on a wind that iced his body. He fell back under the breaking curve of darkness and sound and smell, his ears roaring. He whirled. The stars poured over his sight like flaming meteors. He wanted to plunge in the river again and let it idle him safely on down somewhere. This dark land, rising, was like that day in his childhood, swimming, when from nowhere, the largest wave in the history of remembering slammed him down in salt mud and green darkness, water burning mouth and nose, retching his stomach, screaming. Too much water. Too much land. Out of the black wall before him, a whisper. A shape. In the shape, two eyes, the night looking at him, the forest seeing him. The hound. After all the running and rushing and sweating it out and half drowning to come this far, work this hard and think yourself safe and sigh with relief and come out on the land at last, only to find the hound. Montag gave one last agonized shout, as if this were too much for any man. The shape exploded away, the eyes vanished. The leaf piles flew up in a dry shower. Montag was alone in the wilderness. A deer. He smelled the heavy musk, like perfume, mingled with blood and the gummed exhalation of the animal's breath, all cardamom and moss and ragweed odor in this huge night, where the trees ran at him, pulled away, ran, pulled away, to the pulse of the heart behind his eyes. There must have been a billion leaves on the land. He waded in them, a dry river smelling of hot cloves and warm dust. And the other smells. There was a smell like a cut potato from all the land, raw and cold and white from having the moon on it most of the night. There was a smell like pickles from a bottle and a smell like parsley on the table at home. There was a faint yellow odor like mustard from a jar. There was a smell like carnations from the yard next door. He put down his hand and felt a weed rise up like a child brushing him. His fingers smelled of licorice. He stood breathing. And the more he breathed the land in, the more he was filled up with all the details of the land. He was not empty. There was more than enough here to fill him. There would always be more than enough. He walked in the shallow tide of leaves, stumbling. And in the middle of the strangeness, a familiarity. His foot hit something that rang dully. He moved his hand on the ground, a yard this way, a yard that. The railroad track. The track that came out of the city and rusted across the land, through forests and woods, deserted now by the river. Here was the path to wherever he was going. Here was the single familiar thing, the magic charm he might need a little while, to touch, to feel beneath his feet as he moved on into the bramble bushes and the lakes of smelling and feeling and touching, among the whispers and the blowing down of leaves. He walked on the track. And he was surprised to learn how certain he suddenly was of a single fact he could not prove. Once, long ago, Clarice had walked here, where he was walking now. Half an hour later, cold, and moving carefully on the tracks, fully aware of his entire body, his face, his mouth, his eyes stuffed with blackness, his ears stuffed with sound, his legs prickled with burrs and nettles, he saw the fire ahead. The fire was gone, then back again, like a winking eye. He stopped, afraid he might blow the fire out with a single breath. But the fire was there, and he approached warily from a long way off. It took the better part of 15 minutes before he drew very close indeed to it, and then he stood looking at it from cover. That small motion, the white and red color. A strange fire, because it meant a different thing to him. It was not burning. It was warming. He saw many hands held to its warmth, hands without arms, hidden in darkness. Above the hands, motionless faces that were only moved and tossed and flickered with firelight. He hadn't known fire could look this way. He had never thought in his life that it could give as well as take. Even its smell was different. How long he stood, he did not know. But there was a foolish and yet delicious sense of knowing himself as an animal come from the forest, drawn by the fire. He was a thing of brush and liquid eye, of fur and muzzle and hoof. He was a thing of horn and blood that would smell like autumn if you bled it out on the ground. He stood a long, long time, listening to the warm crackle of the flames. There was a silence gathered all about that fire, and the silence was in the men's faces. And time was there. Time enough to sit by this rusting track under the trees and look at the world, and turn it over with the eyes, as if it were held to the center of the bonfire, a piece of steel these men were all shaping. It was not only the fire that was different, it was the silence. Montag moved toward this special silence that was concerned with all of the world. And then voices began, and they were talking, and he could hear nothing of what the voices said, but the sound rose and fell quietly, and the voices were turning the world over and looking at it. The voices knew the land and the trees and the city which lay down the track by the river. The voices talked of everything. There was nothing they could not talk about, he knew, from the very cadence and motion and continual stir of curiosity and wonder in them. And then one of the men looked up and saw him, for the first or perhaps the seventh time, and a voice called to Montag, "All right, you can come out now." Montag stepped back in the shadows. "It's all right," the voice said. "You're welcome here." Montag walked slowly toward the fire and the five old men sitting there dressed in the dark blue denim pants and jackets and dark blue shirts. He did not know what to say to them. "Sit down," said the man who seemed to be the leader of the small group. "Have some coffee?" He watched the dark steaming mixture pour into a collapsible tin cup, which was handed him straight off. He sipped it gingerly and felt them looking at him with curiosity. His lips were scalded, but that was good. The faces around him were bearded, but the beards were clean, neat, and their hands were clean. They had stood up as if to welcome a guest, and now they sat down again. Montag sipped. "Thanks," he said. "Thanks very much." "You're welcome, Montag. My name's Granger." He held out a small bottle of colorless fluid. "Drink this, too. It'll change the chemical index of your perspiration. Half an hour from now, you'll smell like two other people, with the hound after you. The best thing is bottoms up. Montag drank the bitter fluid.
You'll stink like a bobcat, but that's all right, said Granger.
You know my name, said Montag. Granger nodded to a portable battery TV set by the fire.
We've watched the chase. Figured you'd wind up south along the river. When we heard you plunging around out in the forest like a drunken elk, we didn't hide as we usually do. We figured you were in the river when the helicopter cameras swung back in over the city. Something funny there. The chase is still running. The other way, though.
The other way?
Let's have a look.
Granger snapped the portable viewer on. The picture was a nightmare, condensed, easily passed from hand to hand in the forest, all whirring color and flight. A voice cried,
The chase continues north in the city. Police helicopters are converging on Avenue 87 and Elm Grove Park.
Granger nodded.
They're faking. You threw them off at the river. They can't admit it. They know they can hold their audience only so long. The show's got to have a snap ending quick. If they started searching the whole damn river, it might take all night. So they're sniffing for a scapegoat to end things with a bang. Watch. They'll catch Montag in the next 5 minutes.
But how? Watch. The camera, hovering in the belly of a helicopter, now swung down at an empty street.
See that? Whispered Granger. It'll be you, right up at the end of that street, as our victim. See how our camera is coming in? Building the scene, suspense, long shot. Right now some poor fellow is out for a walk. A rarity, an odd one. Don't think the police don't know the habits of queer ducks like that? Men who walk mornings for the hell of it, or for reasons of insomnia? Anyway, the police have had him charted for months, years. Never know when that sort of information might be handy, and today, it turns out. It's very usable indeed. It saves face. Oh, God, look there.
The men at the fire bent forward. On the screen, a man turned a corner. The mechanical hound rushed forward into the viewer suddenly. The helicopter lights shot down a dozen brilliant pillars that built a cage all about the man. A voice cried,
There's Montag! The search is done!
The innocent man stood bewildered, a cigarette burning in his hand. He stared at the hound, not knowing what it was. He probably never knew. He glanced up at the sky and the wailing sirens. The camera rushed down. The hound leapt up into the air with a rhythm and a sense of timing that was incredibly beautiful. Its needle shot out. It was suspended for a moment in their gaze, as if to give the vast audience time to appreciate everything. The raw look of the victim's face, the empty street, the steel animal, a bullet nosing the target.
Montag, don't move, said a voice from the sky.
The camera fell upon the victim, even as did the hound. Both reached him simultaneously. The victim was seized by hound and camera in a great spidering, clenching grip. He screamed. He screamed. He screamed. Blackout. Silence. Darkness. Montag cried out in the silence and turned away. Silence. And then, after a time of the men sitting around the fire, their faces expressionless, an announcer on the dark screen said,
The search is over. Montag is dead. A crime against society has been avenged.
Darkness.
We now take you to the sky room of the Hotel Lux for a half hour of Just Before Dawn. A program of...
Granger turned it off.
They didn't show the man's face in focus, did you notice? Even your best friends couldn't tell if it was you. They scrambled it just enough to let the imagination take over.
Hell, he whispered.
Hell.
Montag said nothing, but now looking back, sat with his eyes fixed to the blank screen, trembling. Granger touched Montag's arm.
Welcome back from the dead.
Montag nodded. Granger went on.
You might as well know all of us now. This is Fred Clement, former occupant of the Thomas Hardy chair at Cambridge in the years before it became an atomic engineering school. This other is Dr. Simmons from UCLA, a specialist in Ortega y Gasset. Professor West here did quite a bit for ethics.
an ancient study now, for Columbia University quite some years ago. Reverend Pat over here gave a few lectures 30 years ago and lost his flock between one Sunday and the next for his views. He's been bumming with us some time now. Myself, I wrote a book called The Fingers in the Glove, The Proper Relationship Between the Individual and Society. And here I am. Welcome, Montag.
I don't belong with you, said Montag at last, slowly. I've been an idiot all the way.
We're used to that. We all made the right kind of mistakes, or we wouldn't be here. When we were separate individuals, all we had was rage. I struck a fireman when he came to burn my library years ago. I've been running ever since. You want to join us, Montag?
Yes.
What have you to offer?
Nothing. I thought I had part of the book of Ecclesiastes and maybe a little of Revelation, but I haven't even that now.
The book of Ecclesiastes would be fine. Where was it?
Here. Montag touched his head.
Ah.
Granger smiled and nodded. What's wrong? Isn't that all right? Said Montag.
Better than all right. Perfect.
Granger turned to the Reverend.
Do we have a book of Ecclesiastes?
One. A man named Harris in Youngstown.
Montag.
Granger took Montag's shoulder firmly.
Walk carefully. Guard your health. If anything should happen to Harris, you are the book of Ecclesiastes. See how important you've become in the last minute?
But I've forgotten.
No, nothing's ever lost.
We have ways to shake down your clinkers for you. But I tried to remember.
Don't try. It'll come when we need it. All of us have photographic memories, but spend a lifetime learning how to block off the things that are really in there.
Simmons here has worked on it for 20 years, and now we've got the method down to where we can recall anything that's been read once. Would you like someday, Montag, to read Plato's Republic?
Of course. I am Plato's Republic.
Like to read Marcus Aurelius? Mr. Simmons is Marcus.
How do you do? Said Mr. Simmons.
Hello, said Montag.
I want you to meet Jonathan Swift, the author of that evil political book, Gulliver's Travels. And this other fellow is Charles Darwin. And this one is Schopenhauer. And this one is Einstein. And this one here at my elbow is Mr. Albert Schweitzer, a very kind philosopher indeed.
Here we all are, Montag. Aristophanes, and Mahatma Gandhi, and Gautama Buddha, and Confucius, and Thomas Love Peacock, and Thomas Jefferson, and Mr. Lincoln, if you please. We are also Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Everyone laughed quietly.
It can't be, said Montag. It is, replied Granger, smiling. We're book burners, too. We read the books and burnt them, afraid they'd be found. Microfilming didn't pay off. We were always traveling. We didn't want to bury the film and come back later. Always the chance of discovery. Better to keep it in the old heads where no one can see it or suspect it. We are all bits and pieces of history and literature and international law. Byron, Tom Paine, Machiavelli, or Christ. It's here.
And the hour's late and the war's begun. And we are out here and the city is there, all wrapped up in its own coat of 1,000 colors. What do you think, Montag?
I think I was blind. Trying to go at things my way, planting books in firemen's houses and sending in alarms.
You did what you had to do.
Carried out on a national scale, it might have worked beautifully. But our way is simpler and we think better. All we want to do is keep the knowledge we think we will need intact and safe. We're not out to incite or anger anyone yet. For if we are destroyed, the knowledge is dead, perhaps for good. We are model citizens in our own special way. We walk the old tracks. We lie in the hills at night, and the city people let us be. We're stopped and searched occasionally, but there's nothing on our persons to incriminate us. The organization is flexible, very loose and fragmentary. Some of us have had plastic surgery on our faces and fingerprints. Right now, we have a horrible job. We're waiting for the war to begin and as quickly end. It's not pleasant, but then we're not in control. We're the odd minority, crying in the wilderness. When the war's over, perhaps we can be of some use in the world.
Do you really think they'll listen then?
If not, we'll just have to wait. We'll pass the books on to our children by word of mouth, and let our children wait in turn on the other people. A lot will be lost that way, of course, but you can't make people listen. They have to come round in their own time, wondering what happened and why the world blew up under them. It can't last.
How many of you are there?
Thousands on the roads, the abandoned rail tracks tonight, bums on the outside, libraries inside. It wasn't planned at first. Each man had a book he wanted to remember, and did. Then over a period of 20 years or so, we met each other traveling, and got the loose network together and set out a plan. The most important single thing we had to pound into ourselves is that we were not important. We mustn't be pedants. We were not to feel superior to anyone else in the world. We're nothing more than dust jackets for books, of no significance otherwise. Some of us live in small towns. Chapter 1 of Thoreau's Walden in Green River. Chapter 2 in Willow Farm, Maine. Well, there's one town in Maryland. Only 27 people. No bomb will ever touch that town. Is the complete essays of a man named Bertrand Russell. Pick up that town almost and flip the pages. So many pages to a person. And when the war's over someday, some year, the books can be written again. The people will be called in one by one to recite what they know, and we'll set it up in type. Until another dark age when we might have to do the whole damn thing over again. But that's the wonderful thing about man. He never gets so discouraged or disgusted that he gives up doing it all over again, because he knows very well it is important and worth the doing.
What do we do tonight? Asked Montag.
Wait, said Granger. And move downstream a little ways, just in case.
He began throwing dust and dirt in the fire. The other men helped, and Montag helped. And there in the wilderness, the men all moved their hands, putting out the fire together. They stood by the river in the starlight. Montag saw the luminous dial of his waterproof watch. 5 o'clock in the morning. Another year ticked by in a single hour, and dawn waiting beyond the far bank of the river.
Why do you trust me? Said Montag.
A man moved in the darkness.
The look of you's enough. You haven't seen yourself in a mirror lately. Beyond that, the city has never cared so much about us to bother with an elaborate chase like this to find us. A few crackpots with verses in their heads can't touch them, and they know it, and we know it. Everyone knows it. So long as the vast population doesn't wander about quoting the Magna Carta and the Constitution, it's all right. The firemen were enough to check that now and then. No, the cities don't bother us. And you look like hell.
They moved along the bank of the river, going south. Montag tried to see the men's faces, the old faces he remembered from the firelight, lined and tired. He was looking for a brightness, a resolve, a triumph over tomorrow that hardly seemed to be there. Perhaps he had expected their faces to burn and glitter with the knowledge they carried, to glow as lanterns glow with the light in them. But all the light had come from the campfire, and these men had seemed no different than any others who had run a long race, searched a long search, seen good things destroyed, and now very late, were gathered to wait for the end of the party and the blowing out of the lamps. They weren't at all certain that the things they carried in their heads might make every future dawn glow with a purer light. They were sure of nothing save that the books were on file behind their quiet eyes. The books were waiting, with their pages uncut, for the customers who might come by in later years, some with clean and some with dirty fingers. Montag squinted from one face to another as they walked.
"Don't judge a book by its cover," someone said.
And they all laughed quietly, moving downstream. There was a shriek, and the jets from the city were gone overhead long before the men looked up. Montag stared back at the city, far down the river, only a faint glow now.
"My wife's back there." "I'm sorry to hear that. The cities won't do well in the next few days," said Granger.
"It's strange. I don't miss her. It's strange I don't feel much of anything," said Montag. "Even if she dies," I realized a moment ago, "I don't think I'll feel sad. It isn't right.
Something must be wrong with me.
Listen, said Granger, taking his arm and walking with him, holding aside the bushes to let him pass. When I was a boy, my grandfather died, and he was a sculptor. He was also a very kind man, who had a lot of love to give the world, and he helped clean up the slum in our town, and he made toys for us, and he did a million things in his lifetime. He was always busy with his hands. And when he died, I suddenly realized I wasn't crying for him at all, but for all the things he did. I cried because he would never do them again. He would never carve another piece of wood or help us raise doves and pigeons in the backyard, or play the violin the way he did, or tell us jokes the way he did. He was part of us, and when he died, all the actions stopped dead, and there was no one to do them just the way he did. He was individual. He was an important man. I've never gotten over his death. Often I think what wonderful carvings never came to birth because he died. How many jokes are missing from the world, and how many homing pigeons untouched by his hands. He shaped the world. He did things to the world. The world was bankrupted of 10 million fine actions the night he passed on. Montag walked in silence. Millie. Millie, he whispered. Millie. What? My wife. Poor Millie. Poor Millie. I can't remember anything. I think of her hands, but I don't see them doing anything at all. They just hang there at her sides, or they lay there on her lap, or there's a cigarette in them, but that's all. Montag turned and glanced back. What did you give to the city, Montag? Ashes? What did the others give to each other? Nothingness? Granger stood looking back with Montag. Everyone must leave something behind when he dies, my grandfather said. A child, or a book, or a painting, or a house, or a wall built, or a pair of shoes made, or a garden planted. Something your hand touched some way, so your soul has somewhere to go when you die. And when people look at that tree or that flower you planted, you're there. It doesn't matter what you do, he said, so long as you change something from the way it was before you touched it into something that's like you after you take your hands away. The difference between the man who just cuts lawns and a real gardener is in the touching, he said. The lawn cutter might just as well not have been there at all. The gardener will be there a lifetime. Granger moved his hand. My grandfather showed me some V-2 rocket films once 50 years ago. Have you ever seen the atom bomb mushroom from 200 miles up? It's a pinprick. It's nothing. With the wilderness all around it. My grandfather ran off the V-2 rocket film a dozen times, and then hoped that someday our cities would open up more, and let the green and the land and the wilderness in more, to remind people that we're allotted a little space on Earth and that we survive in that wilderness that can take back what it is given as easily as blowing its breath on us, or sending the sea to tell us we are not so big. When we forget how close the wilderness is in the night, my grandpa said, someday it will come in and get us, for we will have forgotten how terrible and real it can be. You see? Granger turned to Montag. Grandfather's been dead for all these years, but if you lifted my skull, by God, in the convolutions of my brain, you'd find the big ridges of his thumbprint. He touched me. As I said earlier, he was a sculptor. I hate a Roman named Status Quo, he said to me. Stuff your eyes with wonder, he said. Live as if you'd drop dead in 10 seconds. See the world. It's more fantastic than any dream made or paid for in factories. Ask no guarantees. Ask for no security. There never was such an animal. And if there were, it would be related to the great sloth, which hangs upside down in a tree all day, every day, sleeping its life away. To hell with that, he said. Shake the tree and knock the great sloth down on his ass. Look, cried Montag. And the war began and ended in that instant. Later, the men around Montag could not say if they had really seen anything. Perhaps the merest flourish of light and motion in the sky.
Perhaps the bombs were there, and the jets 10 miles, 5 miles, 1 mile up, for the merest instant, like grain thrown over the heavens by a great sowing hand. And the bombs drifting with dreadful swiftness, yet sudden slowness, down upon the morning city they had left behind. The bombardment was to all intents and purposes finished once the jets had sighted their target, alerted their bombardier at 5,000 miles an hour. As quick as the whisper of a scythe, the war was finished. Once the bomb release was yanked, it was over. Now, a full 3 seconds, all of the time in history before the bombs struck, the enemy ships themselves were gone half around the visible world, like bullets in which a savage islander might not believe because they were invisible. Yet the heart is suddenly shattered. The body falls in separate motions, and the blood is astonished to be freed on the air. The brain squanders its few precious memories, and, puzzled, dies. This was not to be believed. It was merely a gesture. Montag saw the flirt of a great metal fist over the far city, and he knew the scream of the jets that would follow, would say, after the deed, disintegrate, leave no stone on another, perish, die. Montag held the bombs in the sky for a single moment, with his mind and his hands reaching helplessly up at them. Run, he cried to Faber. To Clarice, run. To Mildred, get out. Get out of there. But Clarice, he remembered, was dead. And Faber was out, there in the deep valleys of the country, somewhere the 5 a.m. bus was on its way from one desolation to another. Though the desolation had not yet arrived, was still in the air, it was certain as man could make it. Before the bus had run another 50 yards on the highway, its destination would be meaningless, and its point of departure changed from metropolis to junkyard. And Mildred, get out, run. He saw her in her hotel room somewhere now in the half second remaining with the bombs, a yard, a foot, an inch from her building. He saw her leaning toward the great shimmering walls of color and motion where the family talked and talked and talked to her, where the family prattled and chatted and said her name and smiled at her and said nothing of the bomb that was an inch, now a half inch, now a quarter inch from the top of the hotel. Leaning into the wall, as if all of the hunger of looking would find the secret of her sleepless unease there. Mildred, leaning anxiously, nervously, as if to plunge, drop, fall into that swarming immensity of color to drown in its bright happiness. The first bomb struck. Mildred! Perhaps, who would ever know? Perhaps the great broadcasting stations with their beams of color and light and talk and chatter went first into oblivion. Montag, falling flat, going down, saw or felt or imagined he saw or felt the walls go dark in Millie's face, heard her screaming. Because in the millionth part of time left, she saw her own face reflected there, in a mirror instead of a crystal ball. And it was such a wildly empty face, all by itself in the room, touching nothing, starved and eating of itself, that at last she recognized it as her own and looked quickly up at the ceiling as it and the entire structure of the hotel blasted down upon her, carrying her with 1,000,000 pounds of brick, metal, plaster, and wood to meet other people in the hives below, all on their quick way down to the cellar where the explosion rid itself of them in its own unreasonable way. I remember. Montag clung to the earth. I remember. Chicago. Chicago, a long time ago, Millie and I. That's where we met. I remember now. Chicago, a long time ago. The concussion knocked the air across and down the river, turned the men over like dominoes in a line, blew the water in lifting sprays, and blew the dust and made the trees above them mourn with a great wind passing away south. Montag crushed himself down, squeezing himself small, eyes tight. He blinked once, and in that instant saw the city, instead of the bombs, in the air. They had displaced each other. For another of those impossible instants, the city stood, rebuilt and unrecognizable, taller than it had ever hoped or strived to be, taller than man had built it, erected at last in grouts of shattered concrete and sparkles of torn metal,
into a mural hung like a reversed avalanche. A million colors, a million oddities. A door where a window should be, a top for a bottom, a side for a back. And then the city rolled over and fell down dead. The sound of its death came after. Montag, lying there, eyes gritted shut with dust. A fine wet cement of dust in his now shut mouth, gasping and crying. Now thought again. I remember. I remember. I remember something else. What is it? Yes, yes. Part of Ecclesiastes. Part of Ecclesiastes and Revelation. Part of that book. Part of it. Quick now. Quick. Before it gets away. Before the shock wears off. Before the wind dies. Book of Ecclesiastes. Here. He said it over to himself silently. Lying flat to the trembling earth, he said the words of it many times, and they were perfect without trying. And there was no Denham's dentifrice anywhere, it was just the preacher, by himself, standing there in his mind, looking at him. There, said a voice. The men lay gasping, like fish laid out on the grass. They held to the earth as children hold to familiar things, no matter how cold or dead, no matter what has happened or will happen. Their fingers were clawed into the dirt, and they were all shouting to keep their eardrums from bursting, to keep their sanity from bursting. Mouths open, Montag shouting with them, a protest against the wind that ripped their faces and tore at their lips, making their noses bleed. Montag watched the great dust settle, and the great silence move down upon their world. And lying there, it seemed that he saw every single grain of dust and every blade of grass, and that he heard every cry and shout and whisper going up in the world now. Silence fell down in the sifting dust, and all the leisure they might need to look around, to gather the reality of this day into their senses. Montag looked at the river. We'll go on the river. He looked at the old railroad tracks. Or we'll go that way. Or we'll walk on the highways now, and we'll have time to put things into ourselves. And someday after it sets in us a long time, it'll come out our hands and our mouths. And a lot of it will be wrong. But just enough of it will be right. We'll just start walking today and see the world and the way the world walks around and talks, the way it really looks. I want to see everything now. And while none of it will be me when it goes in, after a while, it'll all gather together inside. And it'll be me. Look at the world out there, my God. My God, look at it out there, outside me, out there beyond my face, and the only way to really touch it is to put it where it's finally me, where it's in the blood, where it pumps around 1,000 times 10,000 a day. I get hold of it so it'll never run off. I'll hold onto the world tight someday. I've got one finger on it now. That's a beginning. The wind died. The other men lay a while on the dawn edge of sleep, not yet ready to rise up and begin the day's obligations. Its fires and foods, its 1,000 details of putting foot after foot and hand after hand. They lay blinking their dusty eyelids. You could hear them breathing fast, then slower, then slow. Montag sat up. He did not move any farther, however. The other men did likewise. The sun was touching the black horizon with a faint red tip. The air was cold and smelled of a coming rain. Silently, Granger arose, felt of his arms and legs, swearing, swearing incessantly under his breath, tears dripping from his face. He shuffled down to the river to look upstream. It's flat, he said a long time later. City looks like a heap of baking powder. It's gone. And a long time after that, I wonder how many knew it was coming. I wonder how many were surprised. And across the world, thought Montag, how many other cities dead? And here in our country, how many? 100? 1,000? Someone struck a match and touched it to a piece of dry paper taken from his pocket, and shoved this under a bit of grass and leaves, and after a while added tiny twigs, which were wet and sputtered, but finally caught, and the fire grew larger in the early morning as the sun came up, and the men slowly turned from looking up river
and were drawn to the fire. Awkwardly, with nothing to say. And the sun colored the back of their necks as they bent down. Granger unfolded an oil skin with some bacon in it.
We'll have a bite. Then we'll turn around and walk upstream. They'll be needing us up that way.
Someone produced a small frying pan, and the bacon went into it, and the frying pan was set on the fire. After a moment, the bacon began to flutter and dance in the pan, and the sputter of it filled the morning air with its aroma. The men watched this ritual silently. Granger looked into the fire.
Phoenix.
What?
There was a silly damn bird called a phoenix back before Christ. Every few hundred years he built a pyre and burnt himself up. He must have been first cousin to man. But every time he burnt himself up, he sprang out of the ashes. He got himself born all over again. And it looks like we're doing the same thing, over and over. But we've got one damn thing the phoenix never had. We know the damn silly thing we just did. We know all the damn silly things we've done for 1,000 years, and as long as we know that, and always have it around where we can see it, someday we'll stop making the goddamn funeral pyres and jumping in the middle of them. We pick up a few more people that remember every generation.
He took the pan off the fire and let the bacon cool, and they ate it, slowly, thoughtfully.
Now let's get on upstream, said Granger, and hold on to one thought. You're not important. You're not anything. Someday the load we're carrying with us may help someone, but even when we had the books on hand a long time ago, we didn't use what we got out of them. We went right on insulting the dead. We went right on spitting in the graves of all the poor ones who died before us. We're going to meet a lot of lonely people in the next week, and the next month, and the next year. And when they ask us what we're doing, you can say, we're remembering. That's where we'll win out in the long run. And someday, we'll remember so much that we'll build the biggest goddamn steam shovel in history, and dig the biggest grave of all time, and shove war in and cover it up. Come on now. We're going to go build a mirror factory first, and put out nothing but mirrors for the next year, and take a long look in them.
They finished eating and put out the fire. The day was brightening all about them, as if a pink lamp had been given more wick. In the trees, the birds that had flown away quickly now came back and settled down. Montag began walking, and after a moment found that the others had fallen in behind him, going north. He was surprised, and moved aside to let Granger pass, but Granger looked at him and nodded him on. Montag went ahead. He looked at the river and the sky and the rusting track going back down to where the farms lay, where the barns stood full of hay, where a lot of people had walked by in the night on their way from the city. Later in a month or 6 months, and certainly not more than a year, he would walk along here again, alone, and keep right on going until he caught up with the people. But now, there was a long morning's walk until noon, and if the men were silent, it was because there was everything to think about and much to remember. Perhaps later in the morning, when the sun was up and had warmed them, they would begin to talk. Or just say the things they remembered, to be sure they were there, to be absolutely certain that things were safe in them. Montag felt the slow stir of words, the slow simmer. And when it came his turn, what could he say? What could he offer on a day like this? To make the trip a little easier? To everything there is a season. Yes, a time to break down and a time to build up. Yes, a time to keep silence and a time to speak. Yes, all that. But what else? What else? Something. Something. And on either side of the river, was there a tree of life, which bare 12 manner of fruits, and yielded her fruit every month, and the leaves of the tree were for the healing of the nations. Yes, thought Montag. That's the one I'll save for noon. For noon. When we reach the city. Afterward. I didn't know it, but I was literally writing a dime novel.
In the spring of 1950, it cost me $9.80 in dimes to write and finish the first draft of The Fireman, which later became Fahrenheit 451. In all the years from 1941 to that time, I had done most of my typing in the family garages, either in Venice, California, where we lived because we were poor, not because it was the in place to be, or behind the tract house where my wife, Marguerite, and I raised our family. I was driven out of my garage by my loving children, who insisted on coming around to the rear window and singing and tapping on the panes. Father had to choose between finishing a story or playing with the girls. I chose to play, of course, which endangered the family income. An office had to be found. We couldn't afford one. Finally, I located just the place, the typing room in the basement of the library at the University of California at Los Angeles. There, in neat rows, were a score or more of old Remington or Underwood typewriters, which rented out at a dime a half hour. You thrust your dime in, the clock ticked madly, and you typed wildly to finish before the half hour ran out. Thus, I was twice driven, by children to leave home, and by a typewriter timing device to be a maniac at the keys. Time was indeed money. I finished the first draft in roughly 9 days. At 25,000 words, it was half the novel it eventually would become. Between investing dimes and going insane when the typewriter jammed, for there went your precious time, and whipping pages in and out of the device, I wandered upstairs. There I strolled, lost in love, down the corridors and through the stacks, touching books, pulling volumes out, turning pages, thrusting volumes back, drowning in all the good stuffs that are the essence of libraries. What a place, don't you agree, to write a novel about burning books in the future? So much for pasts. What about Fahrenheit 451 in this day and age? Have I changed my mind about much that it said to me when I was a younger writer? Only if by change you mean has my love of libraries widened and deepened, to which the answer is a yes that ricochets off the stacks and dusts talcum off the librarian's cheek. Since writing this book, I have spun more stories, novels, essays, and poems about writers than any other writer in history that I can think of. I have written poems about Melville, Melville and Emily Dickinson, Emily Dickinson and Charles Dickens, Hawthorne, Poe, Edgar Rice Burroughs, and along the way I compared Jules Verne and his mad captain to Melville and his equally obsessed mariner. I have scribbled poems about librarians, taken night trains with my favorite authors across the continental wilderness, staying up all night gabbling and drinking, drinking and chatting. I warned Melville in one poem to stay away from land, it never was his stuff, and turned Bernard Shaw into a robot so as to conveniently stow him aboard a rocket and wake him on the long journey to Alpha Centauri to hear his prefaces piped off his tongue and into my delighted ear. I have written a time machine story in which I hum back to sit at the deathbeds of Wilde, Melville, and Poe to tell of my love and warm their bones in their last hours. But enough. As you can see, I am madness maddened when it comes to books, writers, and the great granary silos where their wits are stored. Recently, with the Studio Theater Playhouse in Los Angeles at hand, I called all my characters from F-451 out of the shadows. "What's new?" I said to Montag, Clarice, Faber, Beatty, since last we met in 1953. I asked. They answered. They wrote new scenes, revealed odd parts of their as-yet-undiscovered souls and dreams. The result was a two-act drama staged with good results, and in the main, fine reviews. Beatty came farthest out of the wings in answer to my question, "How did it start? Why did you make the decision to become fire chief, a burner of books?" Beatty's surprising answer came in a scene where he takes our hero, Guy Montag, home to his apartment. Entering, Montag is stunned to discover the thousands upon thousands of books lining the walls of the fire chief's hidden library. Montag turns and cries out to his superior, "But you're the chief burner. You can't have books on your premises." To which the chief, with a dry, light smile, replies, "It's not owning books that's a crime, Montag. It's reading them." "Yes, that's right. I own books, but don't read them." Montag, in shock, awaits Beatty's explanation. "Don't you see the beauty, Montag? I never read them. Not one book, not one chapter, not one page, not one paragraph. I do play with ironies, don't I?"
to have thousands of books and never crack one, to turn your back on the lot and say, no. It's like having a house full of beautiful women and smiling, not touching one. So you see, I'm not a criminal at all. If you ever catch me reading one, yes, then turn me in. But this place is as pure as a 12-year-old virgin girl's cream-white summer night bedroom. These books die on the shelves. Why? Because I say so. I do not give them sustenance. No hope with hand or eye or tongue. They are no better than dust. Montag protests. I don't see how you can be tempted, cries the fire chief. Oh, that was long ago. The apple is eaten and gone. The snake has returned to its tree. The garden has grown to weed and rust. Once, Montag hesitates, then continues. Once, you must have loved books very much. Touché, the fire chief responds. Below the belt, on the chin, through the heart, ripping the gut. Oh, look at me, Montag. The man who loved books. No, the boy who was wild for them, insane for them, who climbed the stack like a chimpanzee gone mad for them. I ate them like salad. Books were my sandwich for lunch, my tiffin and dinner and midnight munch. I tore out the pages, ate them with salt, doused them with relish, gnawed on their bindings, turned the chapters with my tongue. Books by the dozen, the score, and the billion. I carried so many home, I was hunchbacked for years. Philosophy, art history, politics, social science. The poem, the essay, the grandiose play, you name 'em, I ate 'em. And then... The fire chief's voice fades. Montag prompts, and then? Why, life happened to me. The fire chief shuts his eyes to remember. Life, the usual, the same. The love that wasn't quite right. The dream that went sour, the sex that fell apart. The deaths that came swiftly to friends not deserving. The murder of someone or another, the insanity of someone close, the slow death of a mother, the abrupt suicide of a father, a stampede of elephants, an onslaught of disease, and nowhere, nowhere, the right book for the right time to stuff in the crumbling wall of the breaking dam to hold back the deluge. Give or take a metaphor, lose or find a simile. And by the far edge of 30, and the near rim of 31, I picked myself up, every bone broken, every centimeter of flesh abraded, bruised, a scarred. I looked in the mirror and found an old man lost behind the frightened face of a young man. Saw a hatred there for everything and anything, you name it. I damn it. And opened the pages of my fine library books and found what? 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 Montag guesses. The pages were empty. Bullseye. Blank. Oh, the words were there all right. But they ran over my eyes like hot oil, signifying nothing, offering no help, no solace, no peace, no harbor, no true love, no bed, no light. Montag thinks back. 30 years ago. The final library burnings. On target. Beatty nods. And having no job, and being a failed romantic or whatever in hell, I put in for fireman first class. First up the steps, first into the library, first in the burning furnace heart of his ever-blazing countrymen. Douse me with kerosene. Hand me my torch. End of lecture. There you go, Montag. Out the door. Montag leaves, with more curiosity than ever about books, well on his way to becoming an outcast, soon to be pursued and almost destroyed by the mechanical hound, my robot clone of A. Conan Doyle's great Baskerville beast. In my play, old man Faber, the teacher not quite in residence, speaking to Montag through the long night via the seashell tamp-in ear radio, is victimized by the fire chief. How? Beatty suspects Montag is being instructed by such a secret device, knocks it out of his ear, and shouts at the far-removed teacher, "We're coming to get you, we're at the door, we're up the stairs, gotcha!" Which so terrifies Faber, his heart destroys him. All good stuff. Tempting this late in time. I've had to fight not to stuff it in this new printing of the novel. Finally, many readers have written protesting Clarisse's disappearance, wondering what happened to her. François Truffaut felt the same curiosity, and in his film version of my novel, rescued Clarisse from oblivion and located her with the book people wandering in the forest, reciting their litany of books to themselves. I felt the same need to save her. For after all, she, verging on silly, starstruck chatter, was in many ways responsible for Montag's beginning to wonder about books and what was in them. In my play, therefore, Clarice emerges to welcome Montag and give a somewhat happier ending to what was, in essence, pretty grim stuff. The novel, however, remains true to its former self. I don't believe in tampering with any young writer's material, especially when that young writer was once myself. Montag, Beatty, Mildred, Faber, Clarice, all stand, move, enter, and exit as they did 32 years ago when I first wrote them down, at a dime a half hour, in the basement of the UCLA library. I have changed not one thought or word. A last discovery. I write all of my novels and stories, as you have seen, in a great surge of delightful passion. Only recently, glancing at the novel, I realized that Montag is named after a paper manufacturing company, and Faber, of course, is a maker of pencils. What a sly thing my subconscious was to name them thus. And not tell me. Coda. About 2 years ago, a letter arrived from a solemn young Vassar lady, telling me how much she enjoyed reading my experiment in space mythology, The Martian Chronicles. But, she added, wouldn't it be a good idea, this late in time, to rewrite the book, inserting more women's characters and roles? A few years before that, I got a certain amount of mail concerning the same Martian book, complaining that the blacks in the book were Uncle Toms, and why didn't I do them over? Along about then came a note from a southern white suggesting that I was prejudiced in favor of the blacks and the entire story should be dropped. 2 weeks ago, my mountain of mail delivered forth a pipsqueak mouse of a letter from a well-known publishing house that wanted to reprint my story, The Foghorn, in a high school reader. In my story, I had described a lighthouse as having, late at night, an illumination coming from it that was a godlight. Looking up at it from the viewpoint of any sea creature, one would have felt that one was in the presence. The editors had deleted godlight and in the presence. Some 5 years back, the editors of yet another anthology for school readers put together a volume with some 400, count 'em, short stories in it. How do you cram 400 short stories by Twain, Irving, Poe, Maupassant, and Bierce into one book? Simplicity itself. Skin, debone, demarrow, scarify, melt, render down, and destroy. Every adjective that counted, every verb that moved, every metaphor that weighed more than a mosquito, out. Every simile that would have made a submoron's mouth twitch, gone. Any aside that explained the two-bit philosophy of a first-rate writer, lost. Every story, slenderized, starved, blue-penciled, leached, and bled white, resembled every other story. Twain read like Poe, read like Shakespeare, read like Dostoevsky, read like, in the finale, Edgar Guest. Every word of more than three syllables had been razored. Every image that demanded so much as one instant's attention, shot dead. Do you begin to get the damned and incredible picture? How did I react to all of the above? By firing the whole lot. By sending rejection slips to each and every one. By ticketing the assembly of idiots to the far reaches of hell. The point is obvious. There is more than one way to burn a book. And the world is full of people running about with lit matches. Every minority, be it Baptist, Unitarian, Irish, Italian, Octogenarian, Zen Buddhist, Zionist, Seventh-day Adventist, Women's Lib, Republican, Mattachine, Foursquare Gospel, feels it has the will, the right, the duty to douse the kerosene, light the fuse. Every dimwit editor who sees himself as the source of all dreary blancmange, plain porridge, unleavened literature, licks his guillotine and eyes the neck of any author who dares speak above a whisper or write above a nursery rhyme. Fire Captain Beatty, in my novel Fahrenheit 451, described how the books were burned first by minorities, each ripping a page or a paragraph from this book, then that, until the day came when the books were empty and the mines shut and the libraries closed forever. Shut the door, they're coming through the window. Shut the window, they're coming through the door, are the words to an old song. They fit my lifestyle with newly arriving butcher censors every month. Only 6 weeks ago, I discovered that, over the years, some cubbyhole editors at Ballantine Books, fearful of contaminating the young, had, bit by bit, censored some 75 separate sections from the novel. Students reading the novel, which after all deals with censorship and book burning in the future, wrote to tell me of this exquisite irony. Judy Lynn Del Rey, one of the new Ballantine editors, is having the entire book reset and republished this summer, with all the dams and hells back in place. A final test for old Job 2 here. I sent a play, Leviathan 99, off to a university theater a month ago. My play is based on the Moby Dick mythology, dedicated to Melville, and concerns a rocket crew and a blind space captain who venture forth to encounter a great white comet and destroy the destroyer. My drama premieres as an opera in Paris this autumn. But for now, the university wrote back that they hardly dared to do my play. It had no women in it. And the ERA ladies on campus would descend with ball bats if the drama department even tried. Grinding my bicuspids into powder, I suggested that would mean, from now on, no more productions of Boys in the Band. No women. Or the women. No men. Or counting heads, male and female. A good lot of Shakespeare that would never be seen again. Especially if you count lines and find that all the good stuff went to the males. I wrote back, maybe they should do my play 1 week and the women the next. They probably thought I was joking. And I'm not sure that I wasn't. For it is a mad world, and it will get madder if we allow the minorities, be they dwarf or giant, orangutan or dolphin, nuclear head or water conversationalist, pro-computerologist or neo-Luddite, simpleton or sage, to interfere with aesthetics. The real world is the playing ground for each and every group to make or unmake laws, but the tip of the nose of my book or stories or poems is where their rights end and my territorial imperatives begin, run, and rule. If Mormons do not like my plays, let them write their own. If the Irish hate my Dublin stories, let them rent typewriters. If teachers and grammar school editors find my jawbreaker sentences shatter their mushmilk teeth, let them eat stale cake dunked in weak tea of their own ungodly manufacture. If the Chicano intellectuals wish to recut my wonderful ice cream suit so it shapes zoot, may the belt unravel and the pants fall. For let's face it, digression is the soul of wit. Take philosophic asides away from Dante, Milton, or Hamlet's father's ghost, and what stays is dry bones. Lawrence Stern said it once, digressions, incontestably, are the sunshine, the life, the soul of reading. Take them out, and one cold eternal winter would reign in every page. Restore them to the writer. He steps forth like a bridegroom, bids them all hail, brings in variety, and forbids the appetite to fail. In sum, do not insult me with the beheadings, finger choppings, or the lung deflations you plan for my works. I need my head to shake or nod, my hand to wave or make into a fist, my lungs to shout or whisper with. I will not go gently onto a shelf degutted to become a non-book. All you umpires, back to the bleachers. Referees, hit the showers. It's my game. I pitch, I hit, I catch, I run the bases. At sunset, I've won or lost. At sunrise, I'm out again, giving it the old try. And no one can help me. Not even you. This concludes the reading of Fahrenheit 451 by Ray Bradbury. Copyright 1953-1981 by Ray Bradbury. This book was read by Christopher Hurt. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with Don Congdon Associates Incorporated and was produced in 2005 by Blackstone Audiobooks Incorporated, which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audiobooks. If you would like to obtain a complete catalog of our titles or our monthly update telling you about new releases and our new collection of books on CD and MP3 CD, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. You may also obtain the same information from our award-winning website. Our address, all one word, is www.blackstoneaudio.com. Thank you.